This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tom Uecke. The single biggest global ransomware attack yet continues to bite as more details emerge on how a Russian-linked gang breached the company whose software was exploited. In essence, the criminals used a tool that helps protect against malware to spread it widely. Thousands of victims have been identified in at least 17 countries with ransom demands of up to $5 million reported. The attack comes less than a month after U.S. President Joe Biden and pressed the Russian President Vladimir Putin to stop providing safe haven to ransomware gangs, including the one responsible for the latest attack. Rescuers searched through more rubble Monday after the last of the collapsed Florida condo building was demolished, which allowed crews into previously inaccessible places, including bedrooms where people were believed to be sleeping at the time of the disaster. But they faced new challenges from thunderstorms that hit the area as Tropical Storm Elsa approaches the state. Four more victims were discovered in the new pile, according to the Miami-Dade Assistant Fire Chief, telling family members, raising the death toll to 28 people. Another 117 people remain unaccounted for. And Tropical Storm Elsa swept over western Cuba near Havana with strong winds and rain Monday night. Forecasters said it would move on to the Florida Keys Tuesday and Florida's central Gulf Coast by Wednesday. The storm was passing over mainly rural areas to the east of Havana after making landfall in a natural park with few inhabitants. By evening, Elsa had maximum sustained winds of 50 miles per hour. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Canada is easing pandemic-related border crossing restrictions. We get details from AP correspondent Mike Rossia.
Canada is easing some pandemic restrictions along its border with the United States. Canadian citizens and permanent residents who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19 can now skip a 14-day quarantine requirement that has been in place since March 2020. Additionally, eligible air travelers no longer have to spend their first 3 days in the country at government-approved hotels. However, restrictions barring all non-essential trips between Canada and the United States remain in place until at least July 21st. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says plans to totally reopen the border will be announced in a few weeks. I'm Mike Gracia.
A Taliban negotiator reaffirmed the group's commitment to a durable peace for Afghanistan through negotiations rather than military force. Speaking to British broadcaster Sky from Qatar, where Taliban leaders have resumed long-delayed peace talks with representatives from the Afghan government, the negotiator also said that the group had committed to not allowing attacks on the U.S. or its allies from Afghan territory. Taliban has made territorial gains, particularly in the north of the country, since the U.S. announced its withdrawal of troops from the country in mid-April. As the 20th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks approaches, victims' relatives are pressing the courts to answer what they see as lingering questions about the Saudi government's role in it. A lawsuit that accuses the Saudi Arabia of being complicit took a major step forward this year with questioning under oath of former Saudi officials. But those depositions remain under seal, and the U.S. has withheld a trove of other documents as too sensitive for disclosure. The information vacuum has exacerbated the families who have been trying to make the case that the Saudi government facilitated the attacks. Past investigations have outlined ties between Saudi nationals and some of the airplane hijackers, but they have not established the government was directly involved. Recapping one of our top stories, again, the single biggest global ransomware attack yet continues to cause problems as more details emerge on how a Russian-linked gang breached a company whose software was exploited. Criminals use a tool that actually helps protect against malware to spread it quickly. More at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Buddy in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 6th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Eswatini authorities say life is getting back to normal following days of deadly protest.
The situation right now is almost back to normal. Businesses are now operating. People are getting back to work. There is calm in the streets, and we are hoping this will be maintained. As we believe as a country, we can never progress in an environment where there is anarchy.
Nigerian police confirm an unspecified number of students were abducted on Monday in Kaduna State. There appears to be a presidential war of words in Malawi. South African female gun owners question limited handguns for self-defense. And in Zambia, there is a controversy over who attended or did not attend the funeral of founding President Kenneth Kaunda.
There is no way that President Hakainde Hichilema would have gone to a state function where the head of state stated very clearly that it was strictly by invitation. So how do you go and appear at such a function without an invitation?
And Zimbabwe villagers fight Chinese coal mining project near a wildlife reserve. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The government of Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, says life in the country is getting back to normal following days of deadly protest. Government spokesperson Sabelo Dlamini says the protest cost an estimated 3 billion Eswatini currency to the economy and an estimated 5,000 jobs lost due to the destruction of many businesses. Dlamini says the people of Eswatini are proud of their tradition of always resolving their differences without resorting to violence. He says a delegation from the Southern African Development Community, SADC, that arrived in the country on Sunday on a fact-finding mission left on Sunday without completing its mission, but he says the delegation planned to return to the country.
The mission was able to meet the acting prime minister and several other government officials, and they had a brief meeting with civil society. But because of time constraints, they went back yesterday and have made a commitment to come back to finish their assessment of the fact-finding mission.
What can you tell us about these protests? There have been allegations that people were protesting to have a voice in the election of their prime minister, and the army fired on them, killing some people. So what is the position from the government?
These protests, when they started, members of those constituencies were presenting petitions to the constituencies, but unfortunately, that process turned into violence. We saw incidences where members of parliament were attacked, where police who were there to maintain peace and order were attacked. And more than anything, this country is now at the early stages of the third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. And these protesters were obviously not following the COVID-19 protocols and regulations. And government then took a decision to say, before we spread COVID-19, it is better that these petitions are now sent through a more safer environment. Government opened an email address where these petitions can be sent. Unfortunately, then this turned into another unprecedented scenario in this country, where we saw a lot of rioters and looters attacking government buildings, attacking private businesses, attacking cars, and causing a lot of mayhem. Currently, as I speak to you, James, the damage that has been caused to the economy is now estimated at about 3 billion emalange. The estimation is that right now, about 5,000 jobs have been lost because a lot of businesses were attacked and a lot of shops were looted. So the police were there to make sure that peace and order is kept. And the army was asked to join in, especially so that they could provide security to key national infrastructure.
So at stake is the demand by the protesters that they want to have a say in the election of a prime minister. Are they wrong?
James, in Eswatini, this is a country that has always believed in round-the-table negotiations. Whenever we have new ideas, whenever we want to reform anything in statutes or in our constitution, but our political system has been reformed over the years. Government is still insisting that we are a nation of one people. We are a nation which puts forward peace and stability. We expect all of us to still follow the procedures that are available in our constitutions to raise our issues and they will be debated in the appropriate forums, and we will all agree and come up with a lasting solution.
Before I let you go, sir, what is the view of the government? Do you believe that the protesters have been infiltrated by foreigners?
Most definitely, James. We have information that there are foreigners who have taken advantage of the situation to infiltrate these processes. But our security forces are on the ground, James, to ensure peace and order is restored. As I speak to you, the situation right now is almost back to normal. Businesses are now operating. People are getting back to work. There is calm in the streets. And we are hoping this will be maintained. As we believe as a country, we can never progress in an environment where there's anarchy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, James.
Sabelo Dlamini is spokesperson for the Eswatini or Swaziland government. You are speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. Nigerian police in Kaduna State have confirmed that an unspecified number of students were abducted early Monday from the Bethel Baptist Secondary School of Kajuma in Kaduna State. Various reports said as many as 150 students were abducted. In a statement released late Monday, the police said armed bandits in large numbers gained access to the school by shooting berserkly before overpowering school security and abducting an unspecified number of students into the forest. The police statement said a joint team of the Nigerian police, army, and navy operatives were immediately mobilized to rescue the students unhurt. It said the security forces succeeded in securing 26 students, including a female teacher. In another development, the Kaduna State Schools Quality Assurance Authority has reportedly ordered 13 schools in areas vulnerable to bandit attacks to shut down immediately, effective yesterday, Monday. The authorities warned of sanctions against schools that failed to comply. In Zambia, the main opposition United Party for National Development, UPND Alliance, has denied that its presidential candidate, Hakainde Hichilema, was invited to pay his respects at the state funeral of the country's founding president, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. The funeral service, which attracted several African heads of state, was strictly by invitation, according to government officials. But the opposition leader's failure to be present is generating controversy. Critics say he disrespected the memory of the founding president by not honoring the invitation sent to him. However, the UPND says the party's presidential candidate did not receive an official invitation. VOA's Peter Clotty reached Tabo Kawana, a spokesperson for the main opposition UPND Alliance.
We did not receive any invitation at all. Later on in the day, they published an invitation card, which they claimed they had issued to President Hakainde Hichilema. And even if they wanted to continue to claim that they issued it, the one they showed, when you look at it, it is a fake document, because all the cards that were given were handwritten in terms of the invitee and were strapped in a green ribbon. But that one they published was later typed on invitee and in a gold ribbon. So if they had the card, it was in their hands, they never gave us. There is no way that President Hakainde Hichilema would have gone to a state function where the head of state stated very clearly that it was strictly by invitation. Now, you know that where there are various heads of state from other countries attending a function, even security is heightened. So how do you go and appear at such a function without an invitation when the condition given is that it's strictly by invitation? Of course, you have a fracas at the point of entry.
Some Zambians are saying that he is the leader of the biggest opposition alliance, and as such, everybody knows who Hakainde Hichilema is. Once he approached the venue, it would be very difficult to turn him away because he was coming to pay his last respect to the founding president, and he will not be denied that opportunity. How do you respond to those who are of such opinion?
It is a long opinion, because everybody knows who Hakainde is, and everybody knows that Hakainde Hichilema is the incoming Republican president of the Republic of Zambia after these elections. Therefore, they try to lay as many traps as they can. This is a man who, if you recall, not too long ago, the presidential motorcade overtook him. And after overtaking him, they turned around and charged him with treason and locked him up for over 100 days. So every time there's anything to do with the state, and they want him to appear there, it is usually a trap to try and get him into trouble.
There is an opinion poll or research that is out that shows that incumbent President Edgar Lungu will defeat your presidential candidate. What do you make of this new research or finding?
It is laughable because the people that conducted the research are people who are former classmates to the current political advisor to President Edgar Lungu, Mr. Chris Zuma Nzimba. They have even engaged companies from the USA and the UK. And when you look at those companies, they stand dissolved. So this is a joke of an opinion poll. It's a laughable matter. This is a poll based on 40 sampling and therefore garbage in, garbage out. If you ask me to describe this latest opinion poll, simply put, it's garbage.
Thabo Kawana is the spokesperson for Zambia's main opposition UPND Alliance. You're speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, July 6th. In Malawi, there appears to be a presidential war of words between immediate past president, Professor Peter Arthur Mutharika, and incumbent president Lazarus Chakwera. It all started when the former president over the weekend called incumbent president Chakwera a king of thieves for overseeing the plunder of 23 billion kwacha in COVID-19 funds. Former President Mutharika also said that the opposition, when he was president, conspired with the Malawi judiciary to seize power from him. Sean Campodeni is the director of communications for Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera. He says the Chakwera administration was transparent in its investigation and prosecution of the misuse of COVID-19 money.
The insinuation by the former head of state that President Lazarus Chakwera would orchestrate the plunder of public funds is ridiculous and completely outrageous. This insinuation is one that we repudiate for several reasons. Number one, it was President Lazarus Chakwera who commissioned a forensic audit into the usage of the COVID-19 funds and directed that that audit needs to be completed within 30 days. So that on the basis of that forensic report, the president will take measures. When that audit report came out, the president was the one who directed that the audit report needs to be made public so that all those responsible for the abuse of public funds would be known to the general public. That is not the conduct of a president who orchestrated the abuse of state funds. Thirdly, an audit report into the usage of COVID-19 funds is the first of its kind, not only on the continent of Africa, but in the democratic and civilized world. There is no record anywhere on earth that a president audited the usage of COVID-19 funds except here in Malawi by this president. And fourth, it is also significant to note that once that audit report came out, President Lazarus Chakwera took measures and ordered the law enforcement agencies to do their constitutional duty of arresting those responsible. And you might recall that one of the things the president did was to fire one of his cabinet ministers who was found to be responsible for the misuse of COVID-19 funds amounting to $700.
The former president is going back to the election, saying that Mr. Chakwera, who was then in opposition, conspired with the judiciary to steal power from him.
Yes, he made that allegation, but the elections case that nullified the 2019 election was done publicly. It was done independently, and the decision of the Constitutional Court, which was made up of a panel of five judges, made a unanimous decision. And that unanimous decision is now the subject of an award from Chatham House in the United Kingdom as an example of constitutional democracy and the rule of law being upheld by an independent judiciary. The idea that anybody in this dispensation can be maligning that court ruling flies in the face of something that happened in broad daylight. Besides, even after the Constitutional Court and the five judges therein made this decision, there was an appeal that President Mutharika made to the Supreme Court, which has even more learned judges. And even that Supreme Court made a unanimous decision to uphold that decision. And so the idea that he would be standing on a podium today
and saying that the Constitutional Court conspired to overthrow the government, the Supreme Court conspired to overthrow the government, and accusing them of coup d'etat is an attack on the democracy and its institutions in Malawi. And it's not something that we smile kindly on.
I'm kind of wondering, why do you think the former president is coming up with this list of grievances now? For example, the fact that his accounts were frozen.
The behavior of Professor Arthur Mutharika has always mystified Malawians. But thankfully, Malawians don't have to put up with it any longer, because Malawians went to the polls and they told Mr. Mutharika what they think of his behavior. And for him to be coming out now, it really beggars belief. We really don't know what's going on over there in his mind or in his party. So really, the only person who can answer that question as to what is going on in his orbit is Mr. Mutharika himself.
Sean, thank you so much. It's always very nice to speak with you.
Thanks for having me on Daybreak.
Sean Kampodeni is the Director of Communications for Malawi President Lastro Chakwera. You are speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Conservationists in Zimbabwe are trying to rally opposition to a Chinese coal mining project, which is operating in the district with the country's biggest national park. Critics say locals and wildlife will be affected and are urging authorities to move away from coal production towards renewable energy. Columbus Mavunga reports from Mwange District in Zimbabwe.
Most Jinja villagers in Mwange District say they are opposed to the coal mining project by Behavior Investments, but many are unwilling to speak up for fear of retaliation. One of the few willing to express his concern is Maurice Silanda.
My fears are, one, we shall be evicted. Secondly, we've got a river called Inyantuwe. That's where we get water. It's our main source of water. So definitely when this mine succeeds, my fear again is that toxic acids might be found in the river. We have no boreholes. We don't have anything.
About 600 families fear being displaced if the coal project goes ahead. Other villagers are worried that the project will take away grazing land for their cattle and wildlife. But Behavior Investments continues with its exploration project. Zimbabwe's government says Dinde's people were consulted before the company was allowed to start mining. Amkela Sidange is the education and publicity manager for the government's Environmental Management Agency. She says an environmental impact assessment EIA report addressed and cleared all of Dinde's concerns.
An EIA for exploration was done and a public consultation was also done. Their fears, they are all taken care of. In fact, as long as the EIA was done, it's being monitored by the agency, so nothing is going to be done which is outside what the agreement was in the EIA for exploration.
Farai Magu is the director of the Center for Natural Resource Governance, a local NGO. The group is opposed to the Dinde coal mining project, partly because there are no plans on where the villagers will be taken to if they are displaced. That's not all.
Zimbabwe is intending to have a green economy by 2030. We are also aiming at reducing carbon emissions by 33% by year 2030. But that will not happen as long as the country continue to invest in dirty energy, as what is about to happen in Dinde. We will not allow the government to continue talking left and then walking right.
Sibanda, like most villagers around here, says he does not know what tomorrow will bring. The villagers fear that more projects will be approved and encroach into Mwange National Park, the country's largest wildlife sanctuary. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Mwange, Zimbabwe.
A proposed law aims to prevent South Africans from obtaining firearm licenses for self-defense. While gun critics say limiting access to guns has proven successful in reducing deaths, some proponents argue that taking guns out of some hands, especially women's hands, will deepen what the president has called a second pandemic of gender-based violence. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's rate of intimate femicide, the killing of women by their partners, is 5 times the global average, according to the World Health Organization. And the big driver of that, they argue, is the nation's high rate of gun ownership. That's the argument from South African legislators pushing this bill, that fewer guns in public hands has statistically led to fewer gun deaths. Gun owners and advocates disagree and say it matters who is holding the gun. One particularly vocal group consists of women, who say the constant threat of violence calls for self-defense. The nation's unacceptably high rate of sexual violence once led Interpol to name the country the rape capital of the world. President Cyril Ramaphosa recently described gender-based violence as the nation's second epidemic. This 33-year-old woman asked us to conceal her identity out of fear for her safety. That's because, in the space of 3 months, she said, she was raped multiple times. First, by a gun-toting home intruder who broke into her house repeatedly and threatened to kill her sleeping brother. And then, by the friend she confided in. She says both men had guns and used them to terrorize her. Now, she wants one too, and is seeking a license for self-defense.
Because I'll have it with me, I feel like I'll be empowered, you know, and should anything that is life-threatening happen. Obviously, I'll try, like they said, I'll try and get out of the situation, but if I can't, then I'll do what I can to save my life. It basically could be the dividing line between life and death. So I feel like it would help empower me to know that I don't have to give in. If I can't get out of it, then there's a way to disable them from doing what they're trying to do to me or anybody around me at that time.
Her pain was compounded, she said, when her parents blamed her for the assaults. She said she has spent years in therapy and has no desire for revenge. Lynette Oxley is a licensed firearms dealer in Johannesburg who works with women seeking gun licenses. She's also an accomplished sports shooter. In 2015, she founded Girls on Fire, a group that represents women who own guns for sport and self-defense. She says she trains women to think of guns as a deterrent.
If you talk to all of the lady firearm owners that I've spoken to through the years, as they say, it actually makes you less aggressive because you're aware that if you do take that step, it's a big step. It's not something that you want to do. So actually, it calms you down. It makes you actually think about scenarios. And the big thing is get out of the scenario if you can. If you are attacked, then obviously that is your best way of defending yourself against a bigger, stronger perpetrator.
But, says researcher Nahama Brody, who studies gender-based violence, the very valid fears women have can't necessarily be solved with more guns. She pointed to the last time South Africa's government tried to restrict gun access in the early 2000s. Studies showed that gun deaths from femicide dropped significantly.
I really do understand, as a woman living in South Africa, how vulnerable you feel. And how we imagine, because we're told by Hollywood, as well as by gun owner lobbies, that having a firearm on your person is the one thing that's going to make you safe. But the data shows us that firearms make all of us anything but safe. And the most important step that we could take to improve women's safety in South Africa will be to disarm more men, not to arm more women.
Brody argues that if the goal is to protect women, then there are other less dangerous interventions, like better street lighting, more community safety initiatives, and burglar bars on homes. All of these women agree on the actual problem here. South African girls and women feel unsafe on the streets and in their homes every day. But are guns the answer? That's a question facing Parliament in coming months. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Tuesday, July 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a very good day.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation. Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA. Okay.